peaceful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion. It's going to But I'm going to ask that you hold your calls for the time being. Our guest this evening, we're going to call him Christian, and he is a Christian. Thank you.
One penny for them. The only one is feeding them, supporting them is a Christian. So where is the charity of Muslims going? It's going to those guys, the fighters, the killers. Otherwise, we will not see, you know, actually more than 80% of Muslims are hungry.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and right now we have David calling from Tennessee. Hi, David. Do you have a question? Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, Christian friends, and I hope that you can recognize my voice. Can you tell us a little bit about the progression of jihad and the role of abrogation? Because this can explain to people why some Muslims saying and quoting some verses from the Quran about Islam.
Thank you.
about Muhammad's life, about his teaching, it's in Arabic. The English, it doesn't count for me. Even the translation, you have it in your hand, you go and you see that how the Muslims, especially who are trying to convert people to Islam, how they deceive everybody by changing the translation. Like the word kill became fight. Beat your wife in the Quran became beat her lightly. From where you get me the word lightly? I have no idea. This is the translation. So those people, they, in general, even Arab people, they do not have high education when it comes about Islam. They know how to pray, they know how to fast, they know how to fight, they know they have to kill, but they do not know a lot of things about Muhammad. This is why always when I talk to Muslims and I mention those stuff for them, they say, no way, you're a liar. This cannot be true. And when you give the proof, they get shot.
Well, I think that, of course, the one thing that we need to do is to try to convert the Muslims to Christianity. But if they really don't understand their faith, and if you can actually get them thinking about their faith and understanding their faith, but then, of course, they're going to be reading the English. If they're not Arabic and they don't have an Arabic Quran, then you're suggesting that the Quran that is translated into English really is not an accurate one?
Oh, it has have nothing to do with the real one. Absolutely. It's a big difference. And this is what the Muslims, especially in Saudi Arabia, who are supporting the money for the translation they want. They don't want a Western man or a Western woman to understand the Quran in the right way. Because how you explain to someone in the West that you can beat your wife in the year 2005? This is written in the Quran. They have to make it look good. The only thing they can do, they will add some words to it, so they will make it look nicer. How you can explain to someone that a punishment for killing a slave is killing new slaves? How you explain to someone, if someone he decides to leave Islam, you put him in the cross, you cut his feet, you cut his hands, you put nails in his, you hate nails, this is what Muhammad he did. He hated nails, and he put them in the eyes of those people who left Islam. He cut their foot, he cut their hands, and he put them in the cross, and he let them die slowly. This is in the Quran. So how you can make it look good? So they have to play with the translation, so you will not understand. And then when you ask them, they will read to you in Arabic, and you have no idea what he's saying, and you have to accept whatever he's saying.
All right, let's go to Eric, who's calling from Georgia. Well, that's why it's important that we have you to help us understand. Let's go to Eric. Hi, Eric. Did you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, hi. I just want to ask, how do you reconcile the many peaceful verses in the Quran and with the violent verses in the Quran and the Hadith?
All right, and how do you explain some verses are peaceful and some are violent in both the Quran and the Hadith?
Actually, there is no peaceful verse in the Quran, and this is a challenge for anyone to show me one.
Yeah, but what you're saying is, in the original Quran, as it's written in Arabic, in the doctored version that's available to the gullible Christians.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about, I don't know if I get your question in the correct way. You know, the gentleman is asking me, the way I understand, that how I understand there's peaceful verses in the Quran and there is violent verses in the Quran.
Right.
Okay. Well, first, if we study the life of Muhammad, we will see that the Quran, goes in two ways, which means there is the Quran Muhammad, it was delivered to him when he was in Mecca, and there is Quran delivered to him when he came in Medina. So there's Mecca Quran and Medina Quran.
Those are basically two separate books that are combined in the Quran.
It's one.
Right.
But the date he received them, which means before Muhammad he was in power, and after Muhammad he became in power. Like before he had an army to fight for him, and after having an army. So Muhammad, as a nice guy, the one he's talking about, he is the Muhammad, the one he has no men to fight for him. He's just trying to get believers on him. So he was trying to be nice. This is what he mentioned. But there's no peaceful verses in the Quran. His teaching in the beginning was in general. I worship a God. His God is my God. Is the only God in the sky. And this is the moon God, actually, when they call Allah. And I am a nice for everybody. I will do whatever you want. This is his message, trying to convince people to accept Islam. And, I don't know if exactly you know that the Muslims give the black stone. I don't know if you have an idea what the black stone is about. Do you know?
No, I don't.
Yeah, the black stone, This is one of Muhammad's tricks, trying to make those people who worship that black stone to accept him. He kissed the black stone just to make them feel, you know what, I do worship your God. Can you worship my God too? So he was willing to worship any God, just he wanted people to believe in him. And until now, the Muslims did worship that black stone. Actually, they don't worship it, but they kiss it. But the black stone, if people do not know, this is the private part of the women. This is an idol, represents a sexual part of the women. Those people used to worship it as a god because they believed that this is where they started their life. So Muhammad, he was willing even to kiss that part just to convince them to come to his religion.
All right, well, let's ask Eric. Eric, could you give an example of these peaceful verses you in the Quran you're speaking of?
Yeah, I sure can. I'll just give one reference to make it brief.
All right, what's the reference?
It's Surah
2, Ayah 256.
It says,
Surah 256. Are you acquainted with that one at all, Christian?
What?
He's referring to Surah 256, 256, and he says that that's a peaceful reference.
I could read it if you'd like.
All right, but could you just tell us what it... What?
No, I know, but just want to be sure from the number.
Is it 250?
Okay, I know what you're talking about. You're saying there is no enforcement in religion, right? There is no enforcement in religion. This is what you're talking about.
Well, go ahead and read it, Eric.
Okay. Let there be no compulsion in religion. Truth stands out clear from error. Whoever rejects evil and believes in Allah has grasped the most trustworthy handhold that never breaks. And Allah heareth and knoweth all things.
All right, so how would you respond to that, Christian?
Yeah, this is not a peaceful religion, actually. These peaceful verses, because if you understand what is behind this verse, you will know that Muhammad, this is when he was like a guy who had no army to fight. He was just a guy trying to explain himself, and he said that verse, but he changed everything upside down right away to the opposite. Like if we ask the gentleman who is asking the question, what is the punishment for someone who want to leave Islam? He will say, it's death. So how you explain a verse like this? It says, no compulsion in Islam. There's no enforcement in religion. When someone who want to leave Islam, the punishment is death. This is not a peaceful. It's not about peace. It says, you know what, I'm not going to force you, because he cannot. He don't have an army yet. So he was saying to them, I cannot force you. No enforcement in religion. And he contradicts himself big time, and this is one of the contradictions in the Quran, actually, that when he said in Surah 9, verse 29, go and fight those who do not believe in Allah or the last prophet or what he forbidden. So how you say there is no enforcement, and you say, I will go and fight you until you accept me? It doesn't make sense. So
all right, Eric, how would you respond then? It would appear that the first part of the Quran was written, at an entirely different time, when Muhammad did not have an army. Once he got an army, he became increasingly militant. Does that answer your question at all?
Yes, that you have to take the historical context. When he had no army, he wasn't much of a threat because he, very few followers. But when people started following him more,
then he became much more militant. But I think that's what you're basically saying, isn't it, Christian? Thanks so much, Eric.
Thanks.
Yeah, Muhammad, always, like we know, that when you are weak, you cannot do a lot of things. You are weak. You cannot force people to do things. Saddam Hussein, without his army, Saddam Hussein, he's someone hiding underground, right? But when he had his army, he was killing everybody. And the same for Muhammad. When he had no army, he was just trying not to be too harsh and too harsh on them. So he said, no enforcement in religion, but in the surah right away he's saying, go and fight them. But then, when he got people to fight for him, not before. But in itself, there's no verses in Islam about peace. There's no verses about peace. And this is a challenge for anyone, especially, if there is a fellow Muslims, there are people who are Muslims, they are listening to us. I would love to hear someone calling us in the radio show and show me one of them. And I will show you that any verse he will mention, it's not about peace, has nothing to do with peace. There's one, once Muhammad, he mentioned that he can go in peace if he can fight. This is the only case. Like if now the Americans, the Muslims, they are going in war with the Americans. and America is a very powerful country, and Muslims, they found themselves they are going to lose, they can sign a peace, but this is temporary peace, not forever. The same as the peace now going in the Middle East between Egypt and Israel. This is a temporary peace, because the holy order in the Quran to fight forever. But you know what? Because we cannot make it, so we should be smart. If we go for war now with the Israeli, they will destroy us. They are very powerful now. We are very weak. So let us have a piece of paper, and we will fool them, and we will say, we are a peaceful people with you now, and we will go for peace. This is the only case Muhammad, he approved it. And this is why, you know, the Egyptians, when they signed the peace agreement with the Israeli, most of Muslims, they did not get mad, because they know this is a temporary peace until they are ready.
Well, certainly we know that when Sadat signed a peace agreement with the Israelis, that really was more or less his death sentence, because the Muslims then decided to kill Sadat, really because he actually had agreed to peace, at least with the Israelis. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Yeah, well, they decided to kill him because this is a part of Muslims who saw the situation in different ways. They saw themselves, we are not weak while you are signing the peace agreement. We are not allowed to sign as long as we have a power to fight. So this is why they killed him, because they thought, you know what, you are not doing what the Quran is saying. You can only sign with them when you are very weak, and we are not, we can fight them. This is why they killed him.
All right, we've got a caller from Colorado. What was your name? We have a caller from Colorado? No, oh, here we are. We have a caller from Colorado. What was your name, sir?
Mr. Smith.
All right, Mr. Smith, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes. Christian Prince, what is the rule of abrogation? Because from my understanding that all what Muslims consider peaceful verses are being abrogated by the by Tawbah, Surah 9, verse 5, and that this particular verse is called the verse of the sword, and that this verse abrogated or canceled 124 peaceful verses in the Quran. Is that correct?
Well, it does abrogated a lot of verses, as you said, but still they are not peaceful verses. It was just a verses trying to be okay, but not about peace. There is nothing in the Quran about peace. There is no teaching of peace. So yeah, this is a verse abrogated everything before. Like, okay, everything before when I was weak, forget about it. I am Muhammad now, who have a great army. I'm going to kill you all. So this surah, as you say, and you have a good knowledge about the Quran, abrogated a lot of verses in the Quran, and they are not the case. They are in the Quran now, but the Muslims, they have not to follow them. Like, I can give you one of those surah, it's Surah Al-Kafirun. Surah Al-Kafirun, it says, you have your religion, I have mine. Right? This surah is not the case anymore. Why? Because the verse you mentioned, this is surah number 109, by the way, the surah you mentioned abrogated a lot of surahs, not only verses, four surahs, all of them abrogated, which means, abrogation, it means the surah is still in the Quran, but Muslims, they are not going to follow it. And those surahs who Muhammad was trying to be nice for others, like Surah Al-Kafirun says, I have my religion, you have yours. You don't worship my God, I don't worship your God. It sounds nice. It sounds okay. There is no enforcement in religion. Sounds good. But this surah, the one you mentioned, abrogated those surahs. So they're still in the Quran, but they are not the case. And this is what the Muslims try to do. They will show you verses like these, trying to make you believe that the Quran is a peaceful religion, and it's a good religion. You see, there is no enforcement in Islam. When this verse is abrogated, it's not the case anymore. They will show you the surah, Al-Kafirun. It says, you have your religion, I have mine, which means everyone is free to believe in what he want to believe.
Pull that up right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest has been, this evening has been a Christian who is an expert on the Islamic faith, and he's trying to educate the American people as to the true nature of Islam. Now, we've got about 3 minutes before we let you go. So, what are the thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners this evening?
Well, I want to tell first, for everybody, especially Americans, that, you know, don't anyone fool you. Islam is not a peaceful religion. And I don't want anyone, by the way, to hate Muslims. I feel sorry for them. I love Muslims. I believe they are the victims of Islam. And we are, as a Christian, we've been ordered to love everyone, every human being. And I do invite all the Muslims around the world to accept our Lord Jesus Christ, because he's the only one, and the only one who said, love your enemy. There's no great peaceful message like this in the world except the message of the Lord Jesus Christ. And I want them always to compare between a man who says, go and fight everyone, and that there is no religion except the religion of Islam, and the Lord when he says, love your enemy. This is my message for everybody.
All right. Well, I think it sets an important differential, and I happen to believe that there really is one religion, and that's Christianity, and then there are all the other, because all of them, of course, are in one way or another very much anti-Christian. But certainly people of other faiths can come to the United States and live in peace, because at one time we were a Christian nation, and you could come here as a Muslim or as a Hindu or as an atheist and or as a Jew, and you could live here and be accepted. But you go into a Muslim country and you try to either be a Christian or a Jew, and they'll simply make your life miserable, won't they?
Absolutely. And this is why, you know, if anyone he claimed to be following a good religion, the easy question is, if your religion is good, if it's the religion of peace, there's two questions for you. Why, if someone he decides to leave Islam, he has to be killed? And why you don't allow Christian even to go and have a Bible in Saudi Arabia? And just to mention something I forgot to tell you, that in Saudi Arabia, there are cities, Christian and Jew, they are not allowed to go inside. In front of the city, in the highway, there's a big flag that says, Christian and Jew and dogs and pigs are not allowed. If you pass this line, you will be killed. Imagine. So, what kind of religion will make us equal to dogs and pigs?
Not what I would want to have anything to do with. We're out of time. God bless you, and thank you so very much for being with us this evening. It's been a real pleasure having you here, and I hope we can do again and discuss this even further. Good night. God bless you, sir. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening was a Christian Arab, and trying to let the American people really understand the true nature of the Muslim faith. I would simply mention several books that I think are important. One is it Fanatic Islam, a Global Threat, by Avi Lipkin. The book, The Islamic Invasion, and that, of course, goes into the by Robert Morey. The Islamic Invasion, by Dr. Robert Morey. Jihad, the Holy War, Time Bomb in the Middle East, by Lester Summerall, and certainly Prophet of Doom, by Craig Wynn. So that's Craig Wynn. We think he did a tremendous job in that book, and certainly Dr. Morey's book is Fanatic Islam, a Global Threat, by Avi Lipkin. All of these books are well worthwhile reading. You need to understand the true nature of what we're up against. But behind everything going on is that eternal battle between God and Satan. And I am firmly convinced from my reading and studying that the foundation of the Islamic faith is Satan himself. And if you've read the book by Craig Wynn, you'll come to realize all the various references to Satan and the fact that Muhammad himself believed he was demonically possessed. So we really are involved in a spiritual battle, and when we find our leaders, we see our president holding hands with one of the Saudi princes, why we find the family of our president very close to the leaders of both both Bin Laden family and the Saudi royal family. Why are we supporting a feudal kingdom over there? Oh, well, it's for the oil, we say. Well, why then have we done everything we could to block developing our own oil resources and made ourselves dependent upon Saudi Arabia? And why are we doing everything we can today to antagonize Central America, which has vast oil resources, and some people even believe that they far exceed those of Saudi Arabia, and yet we've managed to make Venezuela an enemy as well, And I fear that one day we are going to be very, very real problems because of the foreign policies that are being carried out by our leaders. Now, what is our foreign policy? Why is for America to dominate the world? And if you would like, that is the subject of my July newsletter. It's not ready yet. Right now, I think you need to get a copy of my June newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy, Part 2. That's The Occult Hierarchy, Part 2. And The Occult Hierarchy rules the people who rule the world. And we simply tell you what they say, not what I say. And we give you the quotations from their writings. And you will find out who some of these people are who really rule the world today from the writings of people who've been involved with the other dimension. And we refer quite frequently to a book called Extraordinary People or Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary Beings. That's Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary Beings by Wayne Peterson. We think it's an important book. We offer it. Now, we don't necessarily agree with the spiritual beliefs of the author, but I believe he's an honest man. If the book and so many other items, if you'd like to know more about them, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, that's the June newsletter. And if you have access to the Internet, of course, you can go up on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. You can pull down that newsletter. You can listen to our programs live on the Internet 5 hours a day, and then you can listen to the archive programs. And our purpose and goal is to educate you as to the true nature of the spiritual battle that is being waged today for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. So we ask you, of course, to tell others about our programs. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and ministers. But lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And we'll be back here in just a moment with the second hour, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, back here once again at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls until we ask for them, because we have with us for the next hour one of my favorite guests. And if you are a regular listener to Radio Liberty, I'm sure he's one of yours as well. His name is Tal Brook, and he's from the Spiritual Counterfeits Project. and certainly one of the best informed people in America as to what's going on. And I certainly agree with literally everything he writes and puts out. And we're going to be talking about The War of the Worlds, the new movie, the old movie, and so I'm going to just sort of sit here enthralled as the Tal begins to explore these ideas for you. Tal, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's great being with you.
Why don't you go ahead and certainly I thought your appraisal, your comments were so insightful. Go ahead.
You know, we have seen, you and I have seen hundreds of movies, and that's true with you out there listening. But now and then you get a unique opportunity because, think of it this way, in a way, certain movies, not all of them, but act as a time capsule, if you will, a cultural archive in recording their era. Now listen, folks, if you want to see what has happened to America in 50 years, and man, has it been something, if you compare both versions of War of the Worlds, you're going to see exactly how much things have changed. Now, all of us know that in the 60s, we had the, let's just call it a cultural revolution. Frankly, folks, I was part of that. I did take LSD. I did believe the myth. I went to India for a number of years. I followed the whole Eastern thing. Those of you who've read Avatar of Night know this. Stanley knows it. So I feel I've paid my dues. I wasn't just a weekend dilettante in San Francisco. I went to India and actually had a resident permit. The other thing with me to keep in mind is that I grew up in an atheistic family and got into the occult at a very early age. Now, with that background, let's just go through the first version before we hit the Tom Cruise Spielberg version.
And you're talking about now the first version of War of
the Worlds. War of the Worlds. Right. And that thing is over 50 years old. It was in 1953 that it came out. I saw it in a re-release later, but I was about age 9. And, I mean, the truth is, for its era, it had very good special effects. I mean, they blew me away. And all of you may remember, many of you will, I know Stan knows this, that in 1938, Orson Welles on the radio created the first scare by narrating H.G. Wells' Martian invasion as though it were contemporary news. I mean, let me tell you, the New Jersey Turnpike flooded. Now, as Stan will tell you, some of these things have a lot to do with CIA mind control sort of stuff in just checking crowd behavior. I hear the sound, so I'll back away for now.
All right, fine. I think it's probably worthwhile commenting. There's a book actually written about Orson Welles' portrayal of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, and when this happened back in 1938, it was part of a planned program to see how successful they would be in 1938 at creating a mirage, creating a perception on the part of the American people that we were being invaded from outer space. They wanted to see just how gullible the American people were. At that time, they were pretty gullible. But believe me, it's a lot worse today. We're going to be back in just a moment with our special friend, Tal Brook. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Tal, why don't you go ahead and pick up this story, the comparison between 1953 and,
yep,
of course, the year 2005.
Well, in 53, I mean, I remember being in line at Rehoboth Beach, and this is before we went overseas for diplomatic duty. It was one of those hot summer days, you know, went on the East Coast. Afternoons can be just boring, and I couldn't believe this movie had come to town. So I was on an adrenaline rush, just Dad and me, and that meant a lot. It was the weekend matinee. And the thing essentially opens after some narration and other stuff with a comet, a fiery object in the sky, and it's one of the Martian cylinders disguised as a meteorite, and it comes down in the distance and in the foreground, and this is not an accidental symbol, stands a lone church in a small Southern California town. And it's a very foreboding juxtaposition. Now remember, I grew up in a non-Christian family. So we'll see what this movie meant. And you know, the main characters soon collect around the event. They have a kind of honest and straightforward way of relating. They have an easy familiarity and trust. There's kind of a harmony there. and it starts at a square dance, and all of a sudden everything electrical shuts down, and people wonder, you know, I wonder if that was a meteor. So late at night, three witnesses go there. The top unscrews, and something that looks like a massive metal cobra poises, and it makes sparking sounds and vaporizes the three people. Okay, the next day, the next scene is that Dr. Forrester is a famous scientist who appears, and of course, in perfect synchronicity, is the very attractive local girl. Her name is Sylvia Van Buren. She shows up, and keep in mind, folks, this is before the battle of the sexes and all the weird kind of strange agendas. These two are attracted to each other. There are no strange pirouettes and dances. It's straight attraction. Soon the army appears, and the lesson that we get very quickly is that the Martian death machines, which hover menacingly in the air, and they have this wave, this super repellent force field, nothing can get through. And so we see not only people turn to ash, but pretty soon the best that post-World War II America has, tanks, howitzers, bazookas, even the atomic bomb, nothing gets through. So there's a lesson here that's brewing. There's something we're being told.
All right, you're going to have to hold that for just a moment because we're going to bring our other stations back on board, and I want our listeners to get that message. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Tal is describing the original War of the Worlds. This is the one that came out in 1953, and it really begins when a meteor, at least everybody thinks it's a meteor, strikes the Earth. He comments that in the opening of scenes, there is a lone church, a lone Christian church standing there. And then, of course, it goes from there to the landing of the meteor, and, of course, the Martians come out looking like big, gigantic metal cobras. But nothing can stand against them. None of our weapons, none of our, even our atom bombs, nothing can defeat these Martian sort of like machines that are beginning now to simply take over the world. So pick up the story there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it becomes a full-on conflict, and basically what happens is that one of the key scenes is that this attractive scientist and this attractive woman go off in his plane to escape, and he's just barely above the trees, and he's doing what he can, and the thing crashes. And then there's what you don't find in today's movies, but a very natural, realistic scene where he holds her protectively, she sleeps, she looks beautiful. And so we see, follow me now, affection in an unselfconscious and spontaneous way. You think, my gosh, this is a thing of beauty, a rare diamond in a vast cosmos. It's something, you know, between the lines, man made in the image of God, that makes us very unusual. It's the rare flower of human love. And against the backdrop of conflict, you appreciate it even more. Now, remember, so far we haven't heard of a single swear word. We have a harmonious, honorable culture. Now, it's true, people go chaotic. But this innocent moment of their affection, and I'm making this point from 50 years ago, he's holding her in a field, is filmed and graciously preserved long before the strident voices coming from the war of the sexes, radical feminism, the gay, lesbian, transgender groups, which really descend on the national scene in vituperative power. I mean, they come, nowadays, they're everywhere. But in this movie, it's a welcome break to have all these angry, twisted voices that are now constantly haranguing us out of the scene. They're off stage. They're gone. In today's films, their presence is now obligatory. They're everywhere. But nevertheless, against a backdrop of conflict, we say this love and affection develop between an attractive man and a woman, and this is part of the thing that make us dear as something created in the cosmos. Now, on a lesser level, we've seen examples of bravery and loyalty among the townspeople outgunned by this awesome enemy, but these are examples of human uniqueness, if you will, worth. Okay, at one point they separate. Basically, they have to run because everything's being vaporized, and she's driving a bus through L.A., and it gets trashed in the streets. Clayton is at the Pacific Institute getting scientific devices. Now, this is all after they've had this encounter with a Martian in a farmhouse, you know, where this basic monitor goes snaking through. And then back then, this was really scary. And you hear the Martian craft hovering outside the farmhouse. And then the real shocker is that, and this was well done back then, the Martian arm is touching her on the shoulder from behind. Her face is just fried. They encounter the Martian and both run. They know when the thing gets back in the machine, it's going to try to vaporize them. They make the run. So pretty soon, as I said, they get separated in L.A. He's loading up on scientific material. And, you know, it's everything's on the run. And at this point, they get separated. And we're going to get into the next thing. But in the chaos where their cars are being hijacked, now we see another human trait. Nothing surprising here. We see blindness and self-destruction and savagery, where we carry the seeds of our own downfall. So they're not hiding sin here. At this point, and this is what's interesting in the movie, Clayton's mission becomes finding her, and he knows that she's a devout believer. Her uncle was a very honorable pastor. So to find her, he's got to start searching out churches. It's the only place he knows he's going to find her, in L.A., three of them. And so we get these glimpses. Now, here I'm nine. I've never been to church, okay? I've had a few, I think, exposures to God. This is where it's important to me. I'm sitting there and I see all the decent people running to a church. It's the final place they've got to hide is these glowing, loud devices are just destroying all the buildings. They're trashing the whole planet. In the churches, it becomes increasingly clear that one greater than man will be able, and that's the only one that will be able to save the human race. And so we get into these churches. I'm looking on with absolute curiosity as a nine-year-old, and they're basically praying impassioned prayers for a miracle. They're desperate. There's every fear that the churches are going to soon collapse. You see the death rays rippling through the stained glass window. They're urgent pleas for divine intervention. He hadn't found it yet, but he finally, in the third church, sees her. They embrace, and then they realize that their need's greater than them. The pastor this time has a really urgent plea for divine intervention. And, you know, mankind's on the brink. Suddenly outside, cause and effect here, folks. What are they doing? They're praying. Outside in the 53 version 50 years ago, there's a sudden quiet. So they go outside the church, and what had been colorful death rays go black. What had been loud sound you don't hear anymore. And then this thing, this giant Martian machine, begins to falter in the air, and it crashes on the ground, and soon a lone arm extends through a portal. And this is key. Dr. Forrester puts his hand on it, and then he looks up towards the sky, and the camera zooms in on him. It's Gene Barry, the handsome actor. And he sort of says, mysteriously, "We prayed to God for a miracle." Well, at that point, the narrative voice that opened the film continues with the observation that Earth's smallest creatures, its microbes, by the grand design of God, was there to basically destroy the Martians. They had no resistance to it. To my young mind, and this is years before I came to Christ in India, this is something that I tucked away. That's why I'm very interested in pre-evangelism. To my young mind, an important message had been given. Number one, people sought refuge where? In the church. That was where they went for solace, for safety, for protection. They prayed to God. And then we saw the machines crashing down. As I left the movie theater, I tucked the message deep in my soul. And as I said, one day in India, I would kneel down calling on the same God. My dad, who was an agnostic or atheist, sort of shrugged. Because I suppose among the intelligentsia of that day, the sophisticated people were all agnostic. It's kind of like wearing certain clothes, if you understand what I'm saying. Intellectual, tides come and go. Now, that was, in many ways, a beautiful film, and you leave feeling uplifted and hope. And you say, okay, what's going to happen 50 years later when Spielberg and Cruise do it?
Now, the thing that's so important is that, at least at that time, even though Hollywood may not have been Christian, there was a Christian worldview, and it really encompassed everything in this country.
Yeah. They could not have done what they're doing now on the screen. They had to accurately portray it. It was everywhere. I certainly remember it as a child, even though I grew up in an agnostic family. There were churches everywhere. There was reference to God in public school when I was in third and fourth grade. It was very clearly a Christian nation, and everything felt different. As a writer, I struggle hard to try to recreate something we've lost terribly. And we've lost that, big time. And it was evident there. I mean, you're not going to get the sort of psycho Christians that are now obligatory in movies where they're hallucinating, rolling their eyes, ready to hack someone up. They're in a trailer. They've got a big meat axe on the wall. They're hearing voices. God's going to tell them to hack someone up and rape some animal. I mean, this is where it's gone. But in this film, the pastor was honorable. He was decent. He was good. Now, there are words that we've learned in the past 40 years. And part of the baggage of the change culture, we saw it happen in the 1960s, where all the big standards were overthrown. And then most recently, we're here in Berkeley, and most of my staff are UC Berkeley students. Most of them are A students. And so they learn about literary deconstruction, and they learn about postmodernism, and what they're learning as reality is so bleak, it's sad. And so we're getting this in Tom Cruise's thing. I mean, this thing begins in a very ugly world. It's a much darkened America since the first film. It's people, and this is really key. It's people are all alienated. They're cynical. They're mistrusting. They exist in a kind of chaotic, ethnically diverse soup, and the experiment ain't working because you're not getting along. Unlike the dignified language of the first film, we got trash talk right from the beginning, obscenities. Tom Cruise, playing a divorced dad, cusses out his punk son, who cusses him out. It's trash talk. Same thing with encounters on the street. The language embodies the new bottom line, the realism. Now, the other thing is that true to Spielberg's propensity, we get spectacle and not character. And I'm hearing the music in the background, so I'll back away.
So I think that today many people have this feeling that life is simply a time of quiet desperation, you know.
That's right.
Life is life is tough and then you die, or
that's right.
The no good deed that will ever go unpunished. But that's not the reality that you are look at when you are a Christian. We're going to be back here in just a moment or two with Tom as we compare the War of the Worlds 50 years ago with the War of the Worlds in 2005 and how America has changed, not by accident, but by intent.
No.
We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, Tom, pick up the story there.
Yeah, well, I mean, unlike the humble, winsome scientist, Clayton Forrester in the first film in 53, the male lead is guess who? It's Tom Cruise, and true to form, he's brash, egotistical, alienated from his kids, his ex-wife. He's ready to take on the world, and he does exhibit courage, but it's kind of the contrived, sort of weird, extravaganza-type courage, his Mission Impossible. In this scene, in the beginning, we're over Hoboken, New Jersey. I'm guessing it's a New Jersey dockyard. It looks horrible. He's operating a big crane, moving huge containers. Spielberg, of course, has said in interviews he's pulling in the 9/11 terrorism fears. And this guy's named Ray Ferrier, and pretty soon after work, he races back in a souped-up car through horrendous areas of New Jersey that are near the shore to New York. It's just as ugly as can get. So we're seeing a very ugly America. And the interesting thing is that as he pulls in his drive, the ex-wife and the new hubby are dropping off the kids. And this quit pretty soon, and you know this is going to happen with the Cruise thing, the adrenaline ride ramps up. the punk son steals the car when he's sleeping. He gets in a wreck in downtown. At that point, Cruz has to run off to find the car, and this is where the alien encounter happens. It happens very quick, but basically at a street intersection, one of these immense things happens. It looks like an earthquake where half the world is being swallowed up, and one of these giant, titanic, metallic tripods comes out of the ground and towers over them. And it's the same proportion between a 6'2" man and an ant. I mean, that's the difference. This thing is huge. The interesting thing, and this is a side thing, is that the first thing to get sliced like a loaf of bread is the church, and then the steeple falls off. So, you know, clearly the church is not going to have much of a role in this film at all. And so at this point, Cruz runs home, trying to avoid his other people being just blasted, to get his kids, and then the rest of the movie is a pilgrimage through America, and it's not a happy one. The other analogy I use, I mean, one is Uncle Rex, 6'2", you're in the attic, you're the size of an ant, and he's spraying you with bug spray. You don't have a chance. Or he's 6'2", you're the size of an ant, he's got a fire hose, and you're there with all the garbage in the gutter, and you're being fire hosed into the sewer. There's this whole sense of a planetary sewer. It's very defiling. Now, look, in terms of special effects, Spielberg's rendition of For All the Worlds has the benefit, we all know, 50 years of technological advancement, digital stuff, where anything you think of can be put on the screen. And they do a good job. And then, on the other hand, there's the hype from Hollywood, as we've seen Tom Cruise make the rounds, pushing the film, Scientology, his latest love, Katie Holmes, and we've already forgotten about his second wife, Nicole Kidman. But what we know is we look at the film, it's Tom Cruise on the screen, we're aware it's Cruise, we're aware he's aware. He's trying to be intense, emotionally authentic. Now, the scientist in the first film isn't trying to be emotionally authentic. It's very natural. But we know that Cruz is very aware of himself, and so whether it's a charged moment of him bonding with a kid.
Hold that thought right there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is Todd Brook, and he's comparing the War of the Worlds, 50 years ago, the War of the Worlds today, and the current War of the Worlds. It's a terrible America, and it's not a moral America, it's not a happy America. It is being portrayed, it's really not a very nice place at all, and of course this is done very intentionally by Steven Spielberg, because he has an agenda.
Absolutely. And so we see Cruz bonding with the kids, having emotional moments of authenticity, and guess what? It feels lifeless and hollow. So, I mean, the real deal is that they hit the road, and that's really what the film is, because remember, it's scene over character, and it's an adrenaline run, and the real horror begins. And there are a couple of scenes that kind of give it away. I mean, he's certainly in New Chaos America, gets hijacked when they're staying off all the main highways because those things are just parking lots. So on all these side roads, he ends up, the son actually at that point, driving into a small town near the ferry because they're not going to take a big bridge, they're going to take a ferry. The irony is that they flow with the human masses. We could call them the unwashed masses. And it reminds you again of sewage being shifted along, everyone's dirty, mud-covered, afraid, hopeless, and they get on the boat finally, and it goes out into the sea in one of these huge tripods. This is not a very nice world. Comes out of the sea, looms menacingly over the boat. Cruz looks at his kids. They jump into the water. It's obvious the boat's going to be turned over. That's what happens. And they swim for their life. Now, this is a very telling scene I'm getting to, and it's really a scene worthy of Hieronymus Bosch. And to me, it's really key on the dehumanization that's happened. They're on a bank. They run up it as quick as they can, and they're under a tree and bushes. They're shivering. They look over to a field, maybe a couple of hills away, but they have a clear view, and these huge tripods, three of them, are basically chasing people like herds of terrified domestic animals. And it's on that level. We're getting human domestication messages, and there's a special ray gun that turns them to ash or to powder, and their clothes blow away basically like snow. It's a very eerie image, and you literally at this point see thousands of people vaporized. They're terrified. I mean, there's no hope. There's no God that's going to step in. This is a grim picture. On another hill soon after that, the best that America has in terms of weapons, we see F-16s, Cobra helicopters, etc., plunge at them. We see all this. It's the air is so dense you can't see anything, and you're wondering, well, you know, if it clears, what are we going to see? Well, naturally, I don't need to tell you, it's the tripods. The weaponry has been burned, and it's lying on the ground. There are a number of other scenes. The really grim one is at this little, I guess, farmhouse, and you learn that they also are into eating people. So there's a food basket. Finally, Cruz and the daughter end up in that. You know they're going to be swallowed up and spit out. These things are into spitting blood. So you've got eating people is an added benefit. And he does his act of heroism by launching some grenades in there. It's a long shot. It's hard to believe. But at any rate, pretty soon the film is going to wind down when they get to Boston. He basically drops off the kids. I mean, the hellish journey really comes to an end when he drops them off. They're glad to see their mom and the new dad, and then the things begin to collapse. Now, here's something interesting. They do collapse. The narrator is Morgan Freeman. He does echo the same lines in H.G. Wells about God basically creating the microbes. But here's another thing. Spielberg has something extra in the narrative that he adds, and I think when the music ends, we can get into that.
All right, fine. Well, I think that what we're seeing is an entirely different world. And, you know, movies create our reality, and you must understand they know how to play on our emotions, they know how to play on our minds, but everything you see on the movie screen or the television screen is indelibly imprinted in your subconscious.
Yes.
The ability to make these movies is a very, very great responsibility, a power that can be used for good or evil. And I fear that Steven Spielberg and so many of the people in Hollywood today have an objective. It's not to make money. It's to destroy Christianity.
Yep.
and Christian civilization. They're doing a great job. We'll be back in just a moment here with Talbrook. Well, this is Dr. Sten. Tal, go ahead and pick up the story there.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is I had joked with some of my staff, and we saw the new movie. I said, look, there's no way in this Spielberg Cruise movie they're going to ever go to a church. There's not going to be a redemptive message of God stepping in. And I was right. The only church we really saw was sliced like a loaf of bread and the steeple fell. That was right at the beginning. And what was very interesting is that Spielberg had another voiceover beyond the narration, again, of Morgan Freeman, the original lines of H.G. Wells, God creating the microbes. But then I looked over at one of my staff members, Josh Ong, who's a Cal Berkeley grad, as it began. And I said, look, write this thing down. So this is what he wrote down. Not content with God's original casting as deliverer, Spielberg's narrator closes with the additional lines. He wrote them down verbatim in the movie seat. By the toll of a billion deaths, man has earned his immunity, his right to survive among the planet's infinite organisms. And that right is ours against all challenges, for neither do men live nor die in vain. Spielberg's portrayal of a depraved world that has turned from the things of God and instead trusts itself to its own wisdom and technology is unfortunately becoming all too accurate. So, I mean, indeed, the real ode in the 2005 film is certainly to humanism and certainly not to God. And then I thought, my gosh, what kind of a world are Spielberg's survivors going to rebuild? I certainly wouldn't want to be trapped in such a world. So the reality is that the War of the Worlds 2 is really as much an archive of the America of the present day. It's the first film recorded the America, the much more innocent America, the more virtuous America of the 1950s. And what's sad is that when you compare the two War of the Worlds, you see how much we've lost socially, spiritually, morally, in the intervening decades. It's been a downward journey, and America's undoing, unfortunately, has not even needed the Martians.
I quite personally believe that what has happened has not been by accident. I believe there's been an organized, orchestrated, concerted, and planned program to destroy the very foundation of this once great Christian nation. Because I believe there is a conspiracy against God. People
talk
about a conspiracy. It is a conspiracy against God. It's mentioned repeatedly in the Bible, and the ministers never mentioned.
We'll be right back. I was going to say...
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Tal Brooker. And his point that he made was that although they had Morgan Freeman, who does the voiceover, in the current Steven Spielberg movie, and he says the same words that they said in the first movie, and quoting H.G. Wells, who wrote The War of the Worlds, why, they added to that, and they added on a very humanistic message that really created the idea of almost a sense of hopelessness, you know, and although man was going to rebuild the world, he was going to do it by himself. There was no mention of God or God's guidance or God's help or God's plan for mankind. And so, of course, what Steven Spielberg is portraying and the ideas he's projecting in this new movie is of this wonderful humanistic world where man is going to rebuild society. And, of course, you look at the sort of world that man creates, and it's not a very good one. So pick up the story there, Tal.
Well, yeah, it's bankrupt, and it's after 50 years of, you know, deconstruction, 50 years of apostasy, you know, what we've done with our judicial system, what we've done with such movements as feminism and the gay movement and all the anti-family movements. It's so been cleverly done, and as I told you recently, there's a book, usually I push my own book, I mean your book, Brotherhood of Darkness, my book, One World, covers what we're talking about a lot tonight, and as you know, I go into a number of movies, from Rosemary's Baby in One World to Eyes Wide Shut. Movies are windows into what's going on. But certainly, among what we would call the cultural elite, the liberal elite, the progressive insiders who've been calling the shots, I have read a book very recently, I finished it today, and I mentioned to you, called Hoodwinked, How Intellectual Hucksters Have Hijacked American Culture by Jack Cashel. And what I told you is when I blew out my ankle a week ago, I was kind of trapped in my room, I hate this, but I was going around the dial, and I this is a way of spying on the culture. I mean, you get it through TV and movies. And this guy was on C-SPAN. I thought, gosh, he's really bright. He's really articulate. He's giving away the secrets of what the liberals have done. I mean, he went into one fraudulent campaign after another from Margaret Mead. He hits... this guy, Ward Churchill, who's recently been in the news, his phony background, my gosh, he exposed Kinsey. He goes into, Margaret Mead and Sanger, who started Planned Parenthood, things you'd never know. I mean, background that's just amazing. He goes into the Paris Review. He goes into the darlings of liberalism and how they've intentionally hidden things, certainly in the area of evolution, in the gay agenda. In other words, they have their icons, and at any price, they're going to perpetuate that. He goes into his meeting, my friend Philip Johnson, who wrote Darwin on Trial. As you know, I have lunch with Phil every couple of weeks. Phil of the UC Berkeley Law School. And he goes into the intelligent design movement. Tremendous stuff. He goes into Paul Ehrlich and the environmental loonies. And again, and these guys are basically covering up. When they make a wrong call, and Ehrlich has done preposterous things, what happens is that the cultural elite cover them up. It enters the big memory hole. And of course, incredible stuff about Kinsey, incredible stuff about Supreme Court jurist Oliver Wendell Holmes. We get into the Scopes trial. And this is a fascinating education, and I'm not even pushing my own book. He goes into Judith Reisman, who you know about, who really basically exposed Kinsey as a pedophile who had a small group of perverts, then they became his database. This is very strange. He's pushing the gay movement. He's talking about 10% gays when in fact it's 1.7%. He goes into the environmental thing where DDT was removed when right now malaria is killed, certainly by March 2005. A BBC team at Oxford said, well, it's killed 500 million cases of malaria, and DDT kills 99% of it. So the environmental thing kind of cut down DDT, and it was a whole campaign that talked in the language, and this is true with all these people, they talk in the language of science, but they misuse it. Now, you know, Stanley, being a medical doctor, certainly some of the stuff you've looked at, these people use the mystique of science to push naturalism. But it's bad. It's not even science.
No question at all. In fact, the outlawing of DDT was criminal activities, but Donald Ruckelshaus, who was the head of the EPA,
that's exactly who did it.
Right, and he did this not because it was harmful, because all the arguments that were used against DDT were really fallacious. In fact, you know, if you studied the history of the people who worked in the factories where they made the DDT, they had a much lower level of cancer than the general population. And, of course, it saved approximately 500 million lives. 500 million lives.
That's right.
They did away with it not because it was harmful to the birds or to the fishies. They did it because it was saving so many human lives. And there were actually people that like Alexander King of the Club of Rome, who admitted that in his own writings. And that's, we cover that in our Population Control Agenda monograph. But you're absolutely right. But you want to hear Tal and his views, not mine. Go ahead, Tal.
Well, no, I think you and I are in total agreement. I mean, there's a long list of what he calls cultural icons, and one of the lessons in this book, and it's certainly in my book, One World, is when you take these people on, truth is no defense, and they're going to savage you, and usually it's an ad hominem argument. They're going to absolutely trash you. So it's very sobering stuff. Certainly when Margaret Mead was outed, I mean, here she went to Samoa, what, she was age 22 on a ship. She was then connected to Columbia University. Her thesis was to show the sexual liberation of Samoans who weren't under the Christian morality and all the so-called neurosis, and she lied from top to bottom. She basically partied most of her time and spent a couple of weeks with two teenage girls who were her source. And if you know Samoan culture, they tell you what you want. It's the famous lying and mischief thing. So they basically fed her what she wanted to hear. She concocted these statistics. She came back and proposed that they were amoral. They slept with everyone. They had absolutely libertine sexual habits and were content and happy and not hung up. And then this Australian came there about 40 years later named Freeman, and he said, my gosh, they have to be virgins to marry. They're extremely moral. The missionaries of 100 years before had made it such that most of them were converted. Meat is completely off target. And Freeman got absolutely fried alive for outing Margaret Mead, and he interviewed the two women that by then had been grandmothers, and they said, oh, we lied from top to bottom. You have to be a virgin to marry over here. So Mead's whole thing of the primal, liberated, unhung up sort of neo-pagan culture was a complete fabrication. And what's interesting is that the elite at Columbia University and the intelligentsia in New York City went into overdrive to perpetuate her myth and keep the outing from hitting the surface. And this is one of many cases like this.
But I think what was really so important is they were actually pushing this libertine concept here. They wanted, of course,
yes,
the sexual freedom. They wanted the sexual revolution here in America.
Yep.
If it works so well in Samoa, why wouldn't it work here? The coming of age in Samoa, I think, was their the title of what she wrote at that time.
That's it.
And
it wasn't even true with Samoa. It was quite the opposite.
But you see, so much of what's going on today is built upon a lie. But when they control the media, and they control the movies, and they control television, and they control the universities, where are you going to learn the truth?
That's exactly it. I mean, that was the whole agenda in going way back to quotes that you and I know over a century ago, where if you happen to own movies and you own publishing and you own the media, this is a colossal power in the monopoly game of world hegemony. And you put any slant you want. And you know darn well, if you look at Dan Rather, who thankfully is off the air, he's a politically correct talking head who postures as though he's got this great liberal conscience. I'm sure he's filled with self-hate because he's completely inauthentic. And then he parrots back the politically correct multicultural dictum of the moment. It's and we get this to no end on all the networks, and very few do you have any sort of moment of honesty. It's terrible.
Well, I think you can see as you watch the movies and you watch television, you realize there's an intense hatred of God, there's an intense hatred of Christianity.
Yeah.
When you understand that, then so much of what's going on, it makes very good sense. How much time do they spend glorifying homosexuals? How much time do they spend building up and praising Christian morality?
Zero.
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 Or even maybe minus five.
Well, minus five, yeah.
Right.
Look, and we saw them praise the Marxists. There's a very telling thing in this book, and I mentioned it in One World. Walter Duranty, the celebrated New York Times correspondent who was in Moscow, completely reinvented history. He looked the other way. He became a champion of Stalin. As around from 60 to 100 million people were killed. He covered it up. He wanted that esteem prize. He wanted the mystique. He wanted big crowds at the Waldorf Astoria to greet him, standing up with ovations after ovations, and he gets the Pulitzer Prize, and he's going to sell truth down the river for numero uno. Now, I knew his counterpart. As you well know, I knew Malcolm Muggeridge, who went from Cambridge University and was also in Moscow as a correspondent. And finally, Muggeridge, who I used to visit him in Robertsbridge, finally said, I can't go on with this sham. What I'm seeing is horrendous. And later he had a conversion. He went from being the darling of the Fabian socialists. I mean, his parents knew Beatrice and Sidney Webb. He went from being a Cambridge darling of the Fabian socialists is saying this thing is a terrible lie. Basically, it's a conspiracy. And then they tried to marginalize him when he came out with the truth. It's an amazing story. They tried to demonize him. They couldn't shut him up, though.
He must have been an amazing fellow.
Well, he was brilliant. I mean, In fact, William Buckley, you know, who's touted as a genius, who did well at Yale, looked on in awe when Muggeridge was in his heyday. I mean, my dad lionized him when he was editor of Punch. He was still liberal. But I saw incredible flashes of the brilliance, and we had quite a good friendship. I met him at the C.S. Lewis play in London, and he had turned out Red Avatar of Night in Calcutta. He was doing the BBC interview of Mother Teresa. He read my book. He said, "Are you the tall brook that wrote this?" I said, "I am." He said, "You're..." I'm not going to say what he said, but it was very encouraging. It really was. And he said, "You've got to come out to our house and have tea with me and Kitty." And I said, "I'd be honored." This guy, Stanley, was an encyclopedia on the left because his parents virtually worshipped Beatrice and Sidney Webb. They met in Croydon, and as you know, H.G. Wells was a Fabian socialist who did War of the Worlds. But even then, I mean, even at the turn of the century, he manages to throw in God. I mean, there was enough of that left. It was interesting.
Well, I think he knew, of course, that this would appeal to the people. And, you know,
yes.
I think that in everybody's heart, it's built into everybody's heart, there is an awareness of God. It's,
yep.
It's part of it, really, into the DNA now. People can reject God, but they know he's there.
They're accountable, and I think Paul's letter to the Romans shows clearly we're without excuse. And the ultimate design argument is that the graded order is the fingerprint of an intelligence of infinite magnitude. I mean, look, a single cell, and I've heard Phil Johnson wax on this, we talk about it at dinner, has more information, folks, than the Encyclopedia Britannica. There's more information of DNA in a single cell than the entire Microsoft Windows program put together with millions of lines of code by Bill Gates and company. This didn't come out of a random accident. You've got to be a colossal idiot to believe that such complexity came out of a random accident. Give me a break.
Well, unfortunately, there are a lot of people educated far beyond their intelligence.
Oh, wait.
That, and many of them are victims of indoctrination at the University of California in Berkeley.
Well,
graduated.
But, yeah, but what they've learned is they sacrifice truth for position and status. And they take a long, pragmatic look, and they learn what pipes to smoke, how to pose as an intellectual, and how to echo back the acceptable language of the day. In other words, they don't have a critical thing that I've learned in the kingdom of God you need to have for salvation, and that's something known as love of the truth. If you have love of the truth, you're going to, I don't care if you're an atheist, you're going to keep looking, and someday God is going to intersect where you are and leave, and you will be accountable. You will know it's Him. That happened to me in India. It happened to me, frankly, numerous times, and I turned God away. But I couldn't at the end because in India, and I go into this in Avatar of Night, I had encountered satanic powers. I couldn't rationalize evil away as some sort of Manichaean equal to good in some partialed-out cosmos. I couldn't rationalize it in a monistic sense. Is just being co-equal with good and of no consequence.
Well, I think this is one new thing you do in your publications there, that you certainly go into the background of this whole movement of evil. Before we lose all of our listeners, I want you to get out your telephone number and
sure.
I want you to get out your website.
Yeah, you can get us. We're here in Berkeley, and the phone number is 510-540-0300. We've done hundreds of journals and newsletters on subjects from witchcraft to the New World Order to eco-environmental lunacy to Teilhard de Chardin to globalism to witchcraft. I think I mentioned witchcraft.
Let's get that website out.
And it's www.scp-inc.org for organization. www.scp-inc.org.
Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest has been Tal Brook, and we've been talking about the War of the Worlds, how America is changing, not by accident, but by intent, And, of course, that there is within every one of us a recognition there is a God. And I think the term that's used in the Bible is they had eternity in their hearts. And so, you know, we each know somewhere down deep inside that there is something greater than us. There is a creator, even we may want to deny that. Certainly universities teach us all about evolution and but, of course, they really don't have the answers where life came from. So they have to say, well, it came from outer space. And then you say, well, where did the life come from in outer space? And they want to change the subject. It should be so obvious to everybody that there had to be a creator. If this one cell, as Tal was saying, contained more information than the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. Well, you got about 2 minutes to wrap up the program, Tal.
Well, I mean, I think we're in a critical time in history, and if you don't know it, there's every parameter that's loaded up right now. From the economic perspective in America, people talk about the national debt, the devaluation of the dollar, the global marketplace with huge banks shifting money back and forth, the fact that we no longer under the Treasury, but a private group called the Federal Reserve. I go into that in One World. And probably realistically, the way the world order will really be thrown together is through debt management, through global banking. That's probably what's going to happen. They're not going to have to drop any serious weapons. We're in a time of terrorism. We're in a time where people have been miseducated after 50 years of progressive education in public schools. So they don't know up from down. I mean, you get a first-grade boy who knows more about homosexuality than he does number theory or geography or anything else. It's a colossal amoral thing. After the 60s and after postmodernism and deconstruction, this country really does represent what we saw in War of the Worlds, the 2005 edition, a hopeless, dark, chaotic situation without hope. And of course, there is hope in Christ, but there's this phenomenal effort to bury or obfuscate God. I mean, it took, in my case, India, years in India, for me to say, you know, the New Testament really might be true. Maybe Christ really is the Messiah. Let's check out these prophecies.
Hey, we're out of time, Tal. Thank you so much.
You got it.
Always a pleasure. Good night. God bless you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I would simply extend the challenge of what the Tal had said. Why don't you check out the New Testament? Is it possible that Jesus Christ was who he said he was, that he really is the Messiah? Let me suggest that you get the Bible, the New Testament, and read the book of John. Read it through several times and see what Jesus claimed to be. And understand that he has had more influence than all of the emperors and all of the armies and all of the professors and all of the philosophers down throughout all ages. And, of course, we begin our calendar with his birth here in the Western civilization. And, of course, the Supreme Court doesn't like that, but they haven't changed the calendar yet because, you see, the people in the Supreme Court hate the God of the Bible. That's why they're there on the Supreme Court. That's why they were appointed. And many of them are deeply involved in the occult. In fact, every one of the people on the Supreme Court who votes against the basic principles of our system was put there by a Mason or somebody associated with Skull and Bones or with the Council on Foreign Relations. Every single one of them. But you're never going to hear that from Rush Limbaugh. Well, let me simply mention Tal's book, One World, and his book Avatar of Light of Night. That's One World and Avatar of Night, and we actually carry both of those books here at Radio Liberty. If you'd like more information, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And let me point out that Tal's ministry is very, very similar to ours. His is very intellectual, though. His spiritual counterfeits publications really give you tremendous insight. You know, you need a dictionary to read them, but they will really stimulate you. Written by some of the finest writers in the United States, and I certainly support what he is doing. he does everything really from the article, from the written point of view, from publishing articles and on the internet. We use talk radio because I think that we can reach here why people that he's not able to reach, and of course he'll reach people that I can't reach. But what a privilege it is to have him as a guest here on Radio Liberty regularly and to have him as a friend. So again, his books, One World and Avatar of Night, if you'd like to know more, our number 1-800-5-448-927. If you want to understand who really rules the world today and the spiritual connotation, my latest newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, you can get it on our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Or if you'd like a free copy, why, we'll get send it to you, 1-800-544-8927. We do mention that we're trying to get this evening program, we have an opportunity to get it on 18 additional stations, and if you are in a position to help us, we'd certainly appreciate that. And you can reach us again at that number, 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, it gives you an overview of the spiritual battle in which we're involved today. And believe me, we're on the edge of some terrible things. I believe there is going to be a worldwide epidemic, and millions, if not billions, of people will die. I believe that there will be a third world war, and America will be attacked right here on our soil. I believe we're facing a financial collapse. I believe the people who are engineering this whole thing know exactly what they're doing, and they have a timetable. And you can go back and you can read the map that was put out in 1952 by the internationalists. Who would be occupying what part of the world, and what do you think America was to be occupying? Kazakhstan, Kazakhstan. American troops would be stationed all throughout the Middle East. It was planned back in 1952. Nothing happens by accident. So pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for our leaders and our ministers, but remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, pray for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, we'll be back with you once again. This is Dr. Stan saying goodnight, and may the Lord be with you.